From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
As I read once again the magnificent words of Dr. King upon that occasion and saw how easily we might this very night transpose the word Vietnam for Iraq, and the document would still be an eloquent cry for sanity and for peace.
Actor and civil rights activist Ozzie Davis has died at the age of 87. Today, a tribute. We'll hear his eulogies for Malcolm X at his funeral, Martin Luther King the day after he was assassinated, his speech against the invasion of Iraq, and his conversations with Democracy Now! We'll be joined by actor Danny Glover and journalist Herb Boyd. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, at least 75 people have died over the past 3 days in violence across the country. Earlier today in Mosul, a suicide bomber blew himself up outside a hospital, killing 12 police officers. In Bakuba, a car bomb targeted the provincial police headquarters. 13 people died in the attack. 18 others were injured. On Sunday, 22 Iraqi security forces were killed when a police station south of Baghdad was attacked. On Saturday, at least 33 Iraqis died, including a member of the Baghdad City Council. Meanwhile, on Friday, the Italian journalist Giuliana Segrena was kidnapped while reporting near Baghdad University. The 56-year-old woman writes for the Italian daily Il Manifesto. In other Iraq news, the New York Times is reporting leading Shiite clerics are pushing for the new Iraqi constitution to be based on Islamic law. Early election results show the Shiite coalition, backed by the Grand Ayatollah Sistani, have a commanding lead over the secular Shiite ticket headed by interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi. Time magazine is also reporting a new scandal has emerged at the U.S.-run prison Abu Ghraib. According to the magazine, U.S. jail officials allowed amputations to be performed on detainees by non-doctors. Medical personnel also recycled chest tubs from the dead to the living. And in at least one case, a medic was ordered to cover up a homicide. On her first visit to the Middle East, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice pledged to give the Palestinian Authority $40 million in immediate aid. Rice said the Bush administration is willing to place monitors inside Israel and the occupied territories if the two sides agree to a ceasefire.
And we will work hard to remind all parties, the Israelis, the Palestinians, and the regional states, that they all have obligations to make certain that we can realize the vision of two states living side by side in peace.
On her two-day visit, Secretary of State Rice met with both Israeli Prime Minister General Ariel Sharon and Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas. On Tuesday, Sharon and Abbas planned to meet for the highest-level talks between the two sides since the Intifada began in 2000. President Bush is expected to send a $2.5 trillion budget to Congress later today. Bush is seeking a $19 billion increase in defense spending while cutbacks in a wide range of domestic programs. Faced with a record deficit, Bush is calling for the elimination of some 150 governmental programs. One out of every three of the targeted programs concern education. Public housing residents, Medicaid recipients, and farmers will all suffer cutbacks. In addition, Bush is proposing to cut the budget of the Environmental Protection Agency by $450 million, to cut $100 million from the Bureau of Indian Affairs program that helps build schools, and to cut $200 million for home heating aid for the poor. Meanwhile, Bush is calling for the Pentagon's budget to increase by nearly 5% to $419 billion. However, that total doesn't include the costs of the ongoing wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. In other news from Washington, the Justice Department has decided not to press criminal charges against several CIA officers for their role in the death of the American missionaries in Peru. In April 2001, the Peruvian Air Force shot down a plane acting on information supplied by civilian contractors working for the CIA that the plane was running drugs. U.S. missionary Veronica Bowers and her 7-month-old daughter were killed. In 2002, the Bush administration agreed to pay a total of $8 million to the survivors of the downed airplane, including Bowers' husband and her son. The Justice Department made the announcement one day before Alberto Gonzalez took control of the office. In business news, stocks and tobacco companies jumped Friday after the Justice Department ruled that the federal government cannot seek $280 billion in damages from the tobacco industry. The government had filed a racketeering lawsuit against companies, accusing them of defrauding the American people for 50 years about the dangers of smoking. In New York, a state judge ruled Friday that a state law that effectively denies gay couples the right to marry violates the state constitution. The ruling could open the door for same-sex couples to get married in the state. The city of New York, however, has announced it will appeal the ruling. In news from Africa, the African Union has condemned the military in Togo for carrying out what it describes as a coup. On Saturday, Togo's longtime president, Nasingbe Eyadema, died after heading the country for nearly 40 years. Under Togo's constitution, the parliamentary speaker is supposed to serve as a temporary head of state until a new president is elected within 2 months. However, the Togo army quickly installed the deceased president's son, Faure Gnassingbé, to be his successor. The ruling party endorsed the move and then passed a series of parliamentary votes to change the country's constitution. The African Union Commission president said, quote, "What's happening in Togo needs to be called by its name. It's a seizure of power by the military. It's a military coup d'etat," he said. And in Ethiopia, tens of thousands gathered Sunday to mark what would have been reggae star Bob Marley's 60th birthday. Marley's family chose Ethiopia as the site of the celebration because it is the birthplace of Rastafarianism. Bob Marley died in 1981 at the age of 36. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Actor and civil rights activist Ossie Davis has died. He was found in a hotel room in Miami Beach on Friday, where he was making a movie called Retirement. He was 87 years old. For 5 decades, Ossie Davis had a distinguished career as an actor, a playwright, a director. Along with his wife, Ruby Dee, he was a renowned civil rights activist and an unforgettable figure in the African-American struggle for equality. He performed in some 80 movies, including 6 with director Spike Lee. 2 months ago, he and Ruby Dee were honored at the Kennedy Center for their lifelong contributions to theater, television, and film, as well as for being models of courage and grace in the long struggle for equality in the United States. Ozzie Davis was born December 18, 1917, in Cogdell, Georgia. His given name was Rayford Chapman Davis, but the registrar of births recorded what were supposed to be the initials RC as Ozzie, and it remained his name ever since. Ozzie Davis grew up in the segregated South amid racism and the Ku Klux Klan. As a young man, he hitchhiked to Washington, D.C. to attend Howard University. He dropped out at the end of his junior year and moved to Harlem here in New York City. In 1942, he was drafted in the Army, where he spent much of World War II as a surgical technician in an Army hospital in Liberia. After his discharge in 1945, Ozzie Davis began his career on the stage in New York, where he met fellow actor Ruby Dee. They married December 1948 and were inseparable for the next 56 years. In addition to their acting careers, Ozzie Davis and Ruby Dee had prominent roles in the nation's political stage. They participated in marches for racial equality throughout the South and participated in the 1963 March on Washington. After Malcolm X was assassinated at a Harlem rally in 1965, Ozzie Davis wrote and delivered the eulogy at his funeral. We're going to play that eulogy later in today's program. In 1968, the day after King was assassinated, he also eulogized him in Central Park, and we'll play that address as well. Despite being blacklisted briefly during the McCarthy era of the 1950s, Davis often traveled to Washington to speak before congressional committees about the arts or about opportunities for people of color in Hollywood. In 1992, Ozzie Davis wrote a novel and in 1998 published an autobiography with his wife entitled With Ozzie and Ruby in This Life Together. Ozzie Davis continued his activism up until his death, most recently protesting the war in Iraq and the coup in Haiti. Today, a tribute to Ozzie Davis. We'll spend the hour hearing the eulogies to Malcolm X and Dr. Martin Luther King, his speech against the war in Iraq, our conversations with him during protests on the streets. But we're going to begin with a speech he gave at Riverside Church days after the launch of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. This is Ozzie Davis.
I am indeed Ozzie Davis. I say that so that those whose duty it is to report my behavior back to the proper authorities I am not as smart as Miss Condoleezza Rice. Though she is yet my sister, nor so faithful unto death as General Colin Powell, though he is yet my brother. They have their sense of duty, I have mine. They are loyal to their commander-in-chief, and I am loyal to mine. My commander-in-chief is Martin Luther King, Jr. And more than 30 years ago, he stood in these sacred halls and gave me my marching orders. Though I was predisposed to peacemongering long before I met Dr. King, it started for me with a jolt on that day, August the 7th, when the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, and I was a soldier, 28 years old, faced with the brutal consequences of what my country had done. It was a period that left me in depression, trying to find an answer, because I knew the quandary into which these acts had led us. I fully understood that our technology and our humanity were in full balance. Which one would lead us to the future was the question. I watched in horror when I left the service as my country used the atomic bomb as the center of its foreign policy. How the march away from colonialization in Africa and other places was affected by that concept of ourselves, which under the aegis of Mr. Churchill and also Mr. Truman set out to establish their vision of a world where we had a second-class place and were implored to remain in that position. I saw the struggle for people to be free. I saw the stand we took in 1954 when France was faltering as she tried to reimpose colonialism in Southeast Asia. And when France falled at Dien Bien Phu, I saw us step in and take over. I saw even then that we were on a course that could well lead to destruction. And much later, in the war that came subsequent to that, I saw the country engaged in what Dr. King told us on that night was adventures based on militarism, racism, and poverty, which it was more constrained to pursue than peace and justice and equanimity all over the world. I became that night, as many of you did, citizens who were also drum majors for justice, drum majors for justice, second class, glad to be recruited. I thought, with the pain and anguish of Vietnam, that my country had learned a lesson, that we had decided that there was an end to our reliance on technological tricks and gimmickry. But I see today that I have been mistaken. As I read once again the magnificent words of Dr. King upon that occasion and saw how easily we might this very night transpose the word Vietnam for Iraq, and the document would still be an eloquent cry for sanity and for peace. I have never looked upon myself as a magician. I was not sent by the Almighty to solve all the problems of the world at one fell swoop. I am not morally arrogant. I accept the fact that maybe this generation was not the one designed by fate to bring peace to the world. But I also believe that it is necessary to stay on the march, to be on the journey, to work for peace wherever we are at all times. Because the liberty we cherish, which we would share with the world, demands eternal vigilance. And democracy is no easy path. But those of us who believe in it must be prepared to sacrifice in its cause more willingly than those who are prepared to die in wars of aggression. We, too, must be dedicated to the cause of freedom. And so tonight, I'm happy to join once again with those of you who see the cause as I do. I say to my commanding officer, Martin, here we are. Ossie, Ruby, our children and grandchildren, all our house, all of us, join with millions from one end of creation to the other. Martin, we report for duty, sir. Thank you.
Ossie Davis, speaking a week after the invasion of Iraq began. He was speaking on March 27, 2003, at an event sponsored by WBAI Pacifica Radio at the historic Riverside Church. When we come back, we'll hear more of Ossie Davis over the years, his eulogies for Dr. Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and we'll be joined by actor Danny Glover and journalist Herb Boyd. Stay with us. Slave Driver here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, broadcasting on over 300 radio and television stations around the country, Pacifica, NPR, Public Access TV, PBS stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Networks, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman as we pay tribute today to, it's hard to put the two words together, the late Ossie Davis, but Ossie Davis did die on Friday morning in Florida. He was 87 years old. And as we remember, the great actor and playwright, director, and civil rights activist, we're joined now by Danny Glover from Helsinki, actor who worked with Ossie in 1998, read Langston Hughes poetry together at New York University. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Danny.
Good morning. How are you?
It's good to have you with us.
It was good to be here. I was in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, over the weekend when I heard about Ossie's death and his passing, and certainly he's been on my mind and in my thoughts. He and Ruby have both been on my minds and my thoughts.
So you were in Ethiopia for the anniversary of the birth of Bob Marley with Harry Belafonte?
Yes, we were there together. Harry couldn't make it, but I was there as part of a symposium and the celebration symposium, which is sponsored by the AU and also the United Nations Children's Emergency Fund, UNICEF. And I couldn't help but thinking as I heard about Ossie. In fact, it's so ironic that Ambassador Dudley Thompson from Jamaica was there. And we mentioned the day before, that Friday, we talked about Ossie. Certainly the news hadn't hit the wire yet, but we talked about Ossie. And Ossie would have been there if he could. He would have been at been there for this extraordinary moment. But we lost so much in Ossie. Ossie there is certainly a champion. He stood on the march. He stayed on the march, and he was on the journey. And He was always reporting for duty. There's not a time when you would ask Ozzy, could you sign on to something? Could you be a part of something? Whether it was about the war, the current war in Iraq, or whether it's about Mumia Abdul-Jabbar, whatever it was about, Ozzy was always there for us.
In fact, later in the program, we're going to play Mumia Abu-Jamal's thoughts on Ozzy Davis and an interview that he did with him before he was imprisoned, an interview he did back in 1980. We're also joined by Herb Boyd, journalist and author of a number of books. In your last book, you have a 2-CD set of Ozzy Davis and Ruby Dee reading the history of the 1960s, Herb.
They narrate what I've considered is kind of a veritable soundtrack of the civil rights movement. Just getting them to be a part of the project, of course, I had, like many, many of you listeners and viewers out there, I had admired Ozzy and Ruby from afar. And I was really nervous about working with them and somewhat reluctant even to impose on them, given their hectic schedules, because I knew of their schedules because I've been covering them for the last 20 years. So I'll say the worst they can do is say no. But they said yes. And we went into the studio. We put together the script and everything. And 4.5 hours, we were out of there. Consummate professionals. Just love. Ozzy was just so good in his presentations. And Ruby, Ozzy was determined to do his 3 times, you know, say, look here, you take the best of what I do. And just so tragically ironic that almost 60 years together, that in these last moments, they were so geographically apart, you know. But I think spiritually, they're always combined.
Ruby Dee was in New Zealand.
Yes, when she got the news. And for me, they personify, you know, talk about, you know, America's couple, you know. I mean, they were like the struggles couple. They were out there on call. If they were available and the cause was progressive, they found time to be there.
Danny Glover, I last saw Ozzy Davis at an event that was really a protest rally against the coup in Haiti on February 29th. The Aristides had just been brought back to this hemisphere, to Jamaica, after being pushed out to the Central African Republic. And there were about 1,000 people gathered in Brooklyn, and Ozzy Davis addressed the crowd. Your thoughts on the way Ozzy, and of course he's survived by his wife Ruby Dee, combine politics and theater and art?
Well, Ozzy saw no separation between the two. He linked his social commitment to his artistic commitment. In fact, I spoke with Ozzy about 3 weeks ago, right after New Year's, and we talked, and he said something that I don't have with me, but I jotted down. He said, it's going to take artists to save us and save humanity from machines and technology. We had work to do. So Ozzy knew the role that art played, and knew that culture played in transformation. It knew the role that culture and art played in elevating us as human beings. If you see, I think one of the things that I've always thought about my career is that when I thought about my career, the person that I mirrored my career after, wanted to mirror my career after, was Ozzy Davis, because it was something so very, his presence and his dignity, his presence of, first of all, his enormous size, and then the fact that he was there every moment. And he lost no connection between, whether it's Paul Robeson to Abu-Jamal to the war, to the Aristides, to democracy in Haiti, to the Iraq War, to the Vietnam War. They were all connected. They were all connected, and they were all struggles that we needed to stand up and stand tall for.
Well, Danny Glover, we want to thank you very much for joining us from Helsinki, just back from Ethiopia. And Herb Boyd, thank you for being with us. We're going to turn now to Ossie Davis delivering the eulogy for Malcolm X. This is from the Pacifica Radio Archives. It was at the Faith Temple Church of God just a few days after Malcolm X was assassinated, February 27th, 1965.
My appreciation of Malcolm, in addition to all of the other things he meant as a leader, as a teacher, as a man, a philosopher, as a man who knew the facts of life, as an Africanist, as an economist, as a political scholar, as an agitator, the thing that struck me most about him was that Malcolm was a man. I mean man in a particular sense. Malcolm had created a new style for those of us who would be men to follow. Not only black men, but also white men. Malcolm left us the heritage of manhood, which in our country has long been going out of style. And if you don't believe it, if you'll remember, last March, when 38 people sat by the telephone and refused to pick it up, when a young lady was calling for help, and she called three times, and these 38 citizens who represent us let the lady die without picking up the phone to call the police. That is the state of our manhood in this country today. And those were not Negro people who did that. They were whites. We have ceased to care. We have ceased to be concerned. We have ceased to remember our humanity. We are things. We are cogs. We are close to being dehumanized in this great country of ours. Malcolm came along and said, stop. Stop. You are men. Stop. You do care. Stop, there is life in you. Stop, there is still the possibility that manhood, that courage, that strength, that imagination will make the difference. It was he who rallied our flagging efforts, who taught us to stand up off of our knees, especially the black men, but also the whites, to stand up off of our knees, to address ourselves to the truth, even if we were killed for it. And it's been a long time since that kind of courage and bravery was abroad in our land. We've had men who were martyrs, men who were mighty, men who set us great and good examples. But they had one advantage that Malcolm did not have. They were men of education. They were men of college. They had had training. Malcolm came from the lowest depth. And therefore, in measuring the man, we have to measure the place from whence he came. All of us sitting here tonight, men and women, black and white, can stand a little taller because a man like Malcolm X walked on our earth, lived in our midst, smiled his smile on the face of Harlem. I am happy to have known him. And if there is a possibility of redemption for me, for you, for Harlem, for our country, Malcolm is the man who said that such a redemption was possible. And when he died, he was pointing the way to this redemption. We sat tonight, we were uplifted by the singing, by the dancing, by the presence of great leaders among us. And you must have noticed that our greatest leaders turned out to be women. Now, there is a reason why this is so. And it's the same reason why a man would hesitate to keep a picture of Malcolm X on his wall. And that reason is that as black men, we have been the most systematically emasculated people on the face of the earth. And we have learned, unfortunately, to accept and live with our emasculation as if this is the definition of what we are. Malcolm said, no, you are a man. I will make you see that you are a man. He insisted on ripping the lies from our face, our middle class smugness. He talked to all of us. Get up off your knees. Come out of your hiding place. If your hiding place is gold, come out from behind it. If your hiding place is prestige, come out from behind it. If your hiding place is poverty, if you live in the slums, if you live in the gutters, stand up, look at the sun. You too are a man. And when Malcolm said it, when he looked at you, when he gave you the stuff of your own manhood, how could we resist or deny or do less than the little we did to honor him when he died and here tonight? Great things sometimes show up very small. The cloud no bigger than a man's hand betokened the flood that destroyed the earth. Many looking on the reception, what has happened since Malcolm has been dead, seeing the kind of reception that we have gotten and that we have not gotten, might make the mistake of thinking that we have measured the man, we have put him in his place, and therefore we can safely turn around and forget him forever. But that is not so. I say this to you as I say to myself. If Malcolm and his message, so strong, so bright, and so pure, was too good for those of us who have already reached manhood, there is a generation who is not yet spoiled, not yet degutted, not yet deboiled, not yet emasculated, who, when they come into the light of his truth, will rise up and redeem him and us and all the rest of the world. That is the meaning of Malcolm X.
Ozzie Davis delivering the eulogy for Malcolm X at the Faith Temple Church of God, February 27th, 1965. We got this from the Pacifica Radio Archive and now move forward 3 years to 1968 and the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Ozzie Davis spoke a day after that assassination at a memorial gathering here in New York at Central Park. Again, from the Pacifica Radio Archives, Ozzie Davis.
Brothers and sisters, we gather at this spot in Central Park to make a statement of expression of how we feel about the world as it stands before us. A great man has fallen, and the world waits for our response. The fact that he was an apostle of love and nonviolence might have led many in the world to mistake his personal courage as a man. But nobody who listened to the last words he said on the night before he was slain can doubt that Martin Luther King was one of the bravest black men we have lost in the struggle. Martin King left us not only the example of his life and of his thoughts and his philosophies and his teachings, but this is more important to the young people in our country, to the black people in our country. He left us the example of his death. He knew it was coming, and he didn't run. He didn't change. He didn't back down. He went forward and he met it like a black man always meets it. Now, why was Martin Luther King in Memphis? Was he there just preaching sermons? No. Was he there holding a seminar on nonviolence? No. He was not there delivering a lecture or receiving a Nobel Prize from the high powers of the world. He went to Memphis to help his black deprived brothers win their bargaining rights from the city of Memphis. And we have got to go and see that they get it to them. They talk to us. They talk to us about what kind of people we are. They laugh at us because we have to feed our families from what we can get on welfare. They say to us, why do you ask the government to do so much for you and the government hasn't done anything for anybody else? They say that we love welfare, that we are not men, that we don't care for our wives and our children, that we don't want to work. In Memphis, men are trying to work trying to earn enough to send their kids to schools to put breads on their tables, and you kill the man. How much, America, do you expect us to bear? There is no time left. When we had another brother who stood up for his people, he was gunned down in February of 1965, Malcolm X. Just before Malcolm died, he went down to Selma, where Martin Luther King was having some trouble, and Malcolm went to offer him his hand in friendship. And Malcolm said, "We may differ, Martin King, on tactics, we may differ on philosophy, we may differ on many things, but you are black and I am black, and let's not forget that, and let's stand together on that basis." And isn't it prophetic that just a few weeks ago, Martin Luther King, Nobel Prize winner, big man in the world, popular with black folks, popular with white folks, Martin Luther King went to Newark and visited Leroy Jones and said the same brotherhood statement that Malcolm had made to him: the fact that we are black is enough to establish our unity and the basis of our fight in this country. My wife and I are looking forward to being in Memphis on Monday to carry forward the march that Dr. King was going to. I don't know. The Southern, Dr. King's body is back in Atlanta. The leaders are having a meeting deciding what is to be done. So I don't know what the circumstances are. I do know there will be a march. And I do know that I want to be in that number, and I would like to feel that those of you who stand here, black and white, shamed, insulted, spat in the face of your manhood and your dignity and your belief in democracy by that stupid fool and his bullet in Memphis, that you will be there too. On to Memphis! Those black brothers in Memphis who sent for Martin King, they still need our help. They put up a brave fight, and they lost one of us. But for every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. And as I stand before you, I don't ask whether you are a white Martin or whether you are a black Martin. I ask first if you are a man, and second, if you believe that men should stand or fall for freedom, and third, if you believe that the time for that freedom is now, that you will take those steps. Now! 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 Thank you. Thank you very much.
Ossie Davis, speaking a day after Martin Luther King was assassinated. It was April 5th, 1968, in Central Park, New York. This recording from the Pacifica Radio Archive. When we come back right after the invasion of Iraq began, Ossie Davis talking about the war, and then Mumia Abu-Jamal remembers Ossie Davis. Stay with us.
You're too rude.
Rat Race, Bob Marley, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, as we turn now to Ossie Davis. Several days after the invasion of Iraq, it was March 22, 2003, in Herald Square in New York, that we met up and talked about his opposition to war.
I'm a citizen of this country with a democratic responsibility, you know, to speak out, even if what I say is unpopular. Now, those in our craft and profession who follow the path of celebrity, whose every word or every move is dictated about how it's going to look in the ratings, you know, may have another way to respond to the calls of citizenship. But I am not concerned about that. They tell me that supporting President Bush is patriotic. Well, I would say that a deeper patriotism is required when we consider to whom we owe our patriotic response. Nobody is more concerned for the welfare of the young men and women who are fighting overseas. I want them home so much that I'm out here today saying, peace, peace, stop, bring them home. That to me is patriotism. Mr. Bush has his point of view and his right to express it, and I have mine. On this, we disagree, and it's my patriotic right and responsibility to tell Mr. Bush, who works for me, who spends my tax dollars, that not in my name will you do this.
Ossie Davis, you're wearing a cap that says USS Mason. What is that?
This is a cap representing the only ship in World War II that was manned by black personnel. I didn't know when I fought in World War II that the Navy even allowed black folks to fight independently in one ship. The USS Mason was that ship. So we were doing a documentary about it, and they were kind enough to give me this hat. So in their name and in their honor, as veterans of World War II, I'm wearing this hat.
And you're There's a, veteran,
a
discussion.
Mr. Davis, you're a veteran?
Oh, am I a veteran? Oh, yes, I am. I remember in World War II, sitting one day, August 7th, 1945, and realizing that the bomb that had been dropped on Hiroshima not only killed 220,000 people over there, but part of it fell on me, too. And I recognized that something cataclysmic had happened, an earthquake in my world and in my thoughts had taken place. And it called on me to make a choice. I didn't know it at the time, but somebody finally said, the choice is to live together as brothers or perish together as fools. I come today to say, I choose to live for brotherhood and not for folly. I choose peace and not war. I choose life and not death.
Does the term shock and awe bring memories back of that time?
Yes, it does. It also brings memories of what happens after shock and awe. It's the disorientation and the depression, the dislocation of the human spirit is something, you know, that we wear and bear forever. To go into a city and shock them with the power of our bombs into awe and to submission, to me, is not a sign of bravery. It is rather a sign of bullying. We have this tremendous power, and we exercise it at its full against people who have no quarrel with us, mothers, children, dogs, cats, all life can be obliterated by what we do. Shock, yes. Awe, yes. How close do we come to the end of all civilization by when we do these things? Oh, yes. I'm shocked and I stand in awe of the possibility of the destruction which might include me and mine.
as the bombs rain down on Baghdad, the Academy Awards are going to go on. There's been discussion of a blacklist of actors who are speaking out against war, and some who might even use the Academy Awards as a platform to discuss their views. What are your thoughts about that as an actor?
Well, in the first place, I confess that I've never taken the Academy Awards very seriously. It's an exercise in salesmanship and hype and little more. I do understand its importance to those who participate, and I can empathize or sympathize with those who think that they must say yes and be innocuous in order to be loved. I'm sorry that they feel this way, because it is not true. I don't think an Academy Award, I don't think being a celebrity or being anything else overrides the responsibility to be a decent, humane citizen, fighting like hell to save the possibility of the continued existence of life on this planet. I'd hate to go to hell and say I was busy trying to save the Oscars. Mankind, humankind is at stake. So I say, if necessary, damn the Oscars, full speed ahead to peace.
Do your friends, your colleagues who are actors, feel the pressure right now?
I have no way of knowing how they feel, and if I did, I would not speak for them at all.
What are you doing out here today?
Oh, I've come to join those who believe that peace is the order of the day, and I want to be where the action is, and I think this is where it's at. I wouldn't miss this for anything in the world. Peace, peace, peace. This is where it's at, and this is where I am.
Actor, civil rights, and anti-war leader Ossie Davis speaking a few days after the invasion of Iraq began on March 22, 2003. And today we end the program with Mumia Abu-Jamal and his tribute to Ossie Davis from Death Row in Pennsylvania.
Ossie Davis, our own black shining star. A lion has fallen. Ossie Davis, the deep-voiced, proud, and majestic man, who has performed on stage, film, television, and community centers, has passed from this life at the age of 87 years, leaving behind him the radiant and talented Ruby Dee, his co-star on life's broad stage, and millions of mourners the world over. In whatever role he accepted, he projected a rare and matchless dignity. Ossie Davis was a brave man who didn't just play one on TV. At a time when it was personally, politically, and career-wise dangerous, he stepped forth to support the civil rights struggles of the 60s and 70s and wrote his legacy large in black America's history when he delivered the touching and heartfelt eulogy to the black nationalist leader Malcolm X. His words, leavened with love and courage, were as much a tribute to Malcolm as they were to himself, for they reflected a deep and abiding love for black people, even those seen as enemies of the state. Of Malcolm, he would say, he was our own black shining prince who didn't hesitate to give his life because he loved us so. Many years ago, perhaps around 1980, I had the pleasure of interviewing Ossie Davis and his lovely wife, Ruby. I found a generous, humorous, sweet, and deep soul. Ossie talked about what being in the arts meant to him.
Our history is about survival under impossible circumstances, and I would like to do something that dramatized those instances where we were able to survive even though we didn't have the means to survive. That magical thing that people sometimes have when they reach within themselves and find something that they didn't even know was there that helped us to make it over. And I know these stories, I talk about them, I tell them, but it would be so much better if I could do it in a way that a mass audience could be reached. That means the drama, first of all. That means motion pictures. That means television and radio and everything.
All right, all right. I hear the sound of pure pandemonium breaking loose. The audience is coming in. The actors are stretching, as you say, and groaning and getting their thing together. And the technicians are technicating, whatever technicians do. And you must get ready for the beginning of this performance. We thank you for the time you and your wife have taken. And we want to transmit to you, as well as you transmit to us through your work, through your life, that we love you.
thank you to all the audience who listen to this, to you and through you, that I too love you. Without you, there would be no me. Thank you.
From that spark of inspiration and the magic of a marriage to the wondrous Ruby Dee, the arts, under both of their singular talents, have been rewarded. I asked them about the impact of their politics on their careers, and he easily answered that they always found something to do, if it was a play in a black college or a neighborhood community center, for there was no community that closed their doors to their talent and their spirits. He added that he didn't need much. But for most young people, perhaps the grizzled old guy in Spike Lee's movie Do the Right Thing sparks memories. In the flick, Davis plays Damea, a street figure who pines for the attention of his love interest, played by Ruby Dee. This very role reflects the essence of what Davis and Dee have done for generations now. Taken rather ordinary roles and imbued them with grace and dignity, a reflection of how they touch the lives of millions of ordinary people by reflecting the best that is within them. A country boy from Cogdale, Georgia, Ozzie Davis inspired millions through decades of performances in various media with the essential elements of dignity and a love for one's people. He was a lion, and though he has passed, may his brilliant life inspire the lions and giants to come. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And that does it for today's tribute to Ozzie Davis, civil rights leader, actor, writer. Special thanks also to Noah Hanrahan of the Prison Radio Project, to journalist Herb Boyd, his latest book, We Shall Overcome, with two audio CDs on the history of the civil rights movement as it happened, narrated by Ozzie Davis and Ruby Dee. I'll see people this weekend in Olympia, Washington, and in Phoenix, Arizona. Today's program is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. If you'd like to go to our website, you can sign up for our Daily Digest, which are the headlines every day, as well as media alerts. And you can also get a copy of today's program by calling 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Or you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Special thanks to the Pacifica Radio Archives for the Ozzie Davis eulogies for both Dr. Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Redemption songs, all I ever had. Redemption songs, these songs of freedom, songs of freedom.